Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt. Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
Everybody, and welcome to this very special episode. While we're waiting for our guest to call in, we have the king himself, Carl Kafer, with us.
Greetings, salutations, everyone. Nice to be here.
And for our reviewers last night, we had a little bit of a mess at the end of the show. I'm the producer, I'm the hoobah, so I'm sorry, I take all blame for it. Sorry, everybody.
Well, you know what? I need to apologize to our listeners too. Sometimes we piss each other off. That's why we're the good cop, bad cop, and we do work well together. So, to my listeners and to Steve, and I also send an apology.
Video Grown Dead thing on Thursday, because it's pretty much going to take it. Like Thursday, we're going to be doing a show catching up on some of the news we've missed and. Probably about a half hour to an hour on Videodrome and the Dead Zone.
And also, because we know who we're going to talk about in the first hour. Two people have passed away, so.
Yeah.
So as we wait for our guests, should we give them a little bit of a hint as to who's coming on tonight?
Well, the title says Richard Stanley, so I guess they should know. But in case you don't know, he is really one of the best science fiction directors to come out of the 90s.
You know, and even though I do consider him a science fiction / horror director, he focuses in on character and on more like folk tales and things like that. Very, very interesting director. He also has done a lot of documentaries, and we'll get into that. He also has some a new movie that came out in Germany that he co-wrote, and I also want to talk to him about some of his scripts that have not been picked up yet that hopefully will at one point or another.
And I can really say, when Hardware hit back in, I think it was 89, that just blew everybody away. Didn't it you when you first seen it?
Oh, absolutely. Now, I didn't see it until much later. Somebody recommended it, and I picked up a rental VHS on it. And I was really impressed. Then, of course, his second movie came out, and I became a lifelong fan. Of course, we did a watch on that. That's Dust Devil.
Yeah.
And I love that movie. I love that film.
Well, I didn't watch Dust Devil until the final cut came out, because I've heard how badly the Miramax VHS was massacred. Put it nicely.
Well, Well, I had seen the Miramax, and it's certainly different than the director's cut with Ione. But even in seeing that, I could tell. What?
You're being nice.
Well, all I was going to say was, even in seeing that bastardized version, I could tell that the man had incredible talent. And then when the new, you know, the director's cut came out, it just blew me away.
Yeah, and he's done basically a lot of great documentary work. He did that's one of the best things. If you can find it in the wild or online cheap, Dust Devil to Find a Cut is one of the best DVD sets out there. Because not only do you get Dust Devil, you get a longer work print version of Dust Devil, and you get three of his documentaries.
Yeah, and they're all very good. I finally caught up with them this year. Finally pulled it out and watched the documentaries. He also did... you know, there are these horror anthologies out. And I guess it was 6-7 years ago that one came out called The Cedar Bazaar. And
yeah,
he did a segment of it, Mother of Toads, which I love that segment. Such a great
segment. And he did a
second
one. I forget what its name is, but the damn thing is still not came out.
But I do recommend The Theater Bazaar to everyone. It's a really good anthology. It has his segment. It has a segment from Buddy Giovinazzo, who did Combat Shock, which is really shocking. Has a can't think of who did Sweets. But they are, all the segments are solid. They really are. There's not one bad segment in the whole movie, which is unusual.
Yeah. I'm looking here, and I'm still trying to find it. I remember it was finished, but it never did came out. It's not the theater Bazaar. But the most interesting of his documentaries is one called...
Go ahead. Steven?
Okay. Yeah, the most entering of his documentaries, which he released a sequel to, is The Secret Glory, which is the story of the, well, y'all seen Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. Definitely have seen that.
Well, he did a documentary on the German guy who actually was the one who did the Grail search.
Okay. Yeah, that I remember watching that. That was a good one. That one is on the set, right?
Yeah.
On the Dust Devil. Yeah. Yeah, he intrigues me because, you know, his writing and directing, you know, considering some of the background, which we're not going to get into with a particular film, he's kept himself busy and really, really, you know, done things off the grid to a certain degree. And I think in doing that, you've got to give someone who's an artist some real credit, because his muse, you know, directs him, and not the sense of fame or that sort of thing. And so, you know, I'm very, very envious of him, actually, for that fact. Stephen, are you
yeah.
there?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out something here to get him connected. This has been, Facebook is being, as they say, interesting.
Okay. So is he trying to get in now? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I'm trying to get his cell phone number to get in here, but it's not fucking working because...
Lovely. Okay, so I'll keep working here. When we talk about it, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Carl. I'm working here.
Okay, you keep working. I'll fill the time. So when we talk about Dust Devil, which we did a show on. Well, 3-4 months ago at least. You have to realize that Richard Stanley is South African. He did this film in his native country. Stars Robert John Burke and one of my favorite character actors who have since passed away, that's Saqez Mokai. And when we get along, I'm going to ask him a couple questions about Saqez. And he takes the story of the traveling man who basically, you know, travels the earth immortal, looking for souls that are despondent so he can talk them into basically suicide. And that character is played by Robert John Burke, who's another one of my favorite actors. He's done a lot for Hal Hartley. He also took over the role from Peter Weller in RoboCop 3. But the one thing that you take a look at in his films, and this is true of Hardware also, and Mother of Toads, is that they're really based on old folk tales. And so the feeling of these films are much different. I know most fans that I've encountered love their slashers and love their violence, but in his films, it's more about character. It's more about getting inside the character, and then shit happens after that. And so he's a very deliberate filmmaker, and I like that. You know, you take time, you let the ambiance flow over you and things like that. So, you know, I mean, there's no question, Stephen, is there, that he's one of our favorite directors.
Oh, yeah.
You
know. I've sold
you want to say something
to the Dust Devil set at a used bookstore.
Well, he got the idea of a used bookstore? Is that what you said?
Yeah, that was like there at McKay's, and all of a sudden these guys like talking to each other. I'm looking for something scary that I haven't seen before, and I looked and I was like, "Oh, there's Dust Devil." Then I got into some old, "Sir, have you seen this?" "No." "Let me speak of the religion of my people." And they ended up buying it both times.
You never did hear back from them, though, whether or not they liked it, though.
No, but, hey, how can you not like it?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I know people that don't. I mean, there was a thread. I'm now on Incredibly Strange Films. There was a thread on there that I mentioned and said, and a number of people on that thread said they didn't really like it because it didn't move as quickly as they wanted. They thought it was boring. And that's the thing about Stanley. He takes his time. You know, it's not about the cheap shocks or anything like that. I love it in the moment. Yeah.
Like that surreal moment when the Dust Devil first gets in that small town and you see the little boy shooting the rifle.
Right.
And then you pull back and you see, like, a priest in full garb giving out bullets to the boys.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I really like about Dust Devil is the relationship that ensues between him and the woman who is on the verge of suicide, and how this whole sense of flirting with death and things like that play into it. And of course, you know, the same thing with Sakesmo Kai, who plays the police detective after all this. And I can't say enough about it. I really can't. Maybe we need to say that throughout the whole thing. If we can't connect with Richard, hopefully we can. How's it coming, Steve?
It's coming. I want to take right now. I want to take Blot Talk outside and just beat the holy crap out of them. But that's just me.
Understood. You know, the other thing is I remember running across Theater Bazaar on one of the channels, and I just happened to watch it, not expecting much. And the first episode comes on Mothers of Toads, and I saw the director's credit. And the first words out of my mouth was, "Holy shit!" And I was not disappointed. And that has a very Lovecraftian feel to it. It's basically this couple is on vacation, and this woman gives them this trinket. And she is a witch. She beguiles the man into falling in love with her. And, of course, the title is Mother of Toads, and you can guess what happens from there.
There were a couple of really interesting documentaries where I think that the guys who made it cared more about who they got to direct it than any of the stories.
Okay.
Well, look at the one you like.
Well,
the other one, what is it? Ashes?
Trapped Ashes.
Yeah.
Trapped
Just
Ashes.
Name the directors of that bad boy.
Okay. So on the wraparound, you have Joe Dante. Then you have Ken Russell.
Yeah.
You have Sean Cunningham. And then, holy shit, you've got Monty Hellman doing a story that his segment is basically called Stanley. It's about Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds like, and I don't mean this in a bad way, it's like Carl, like, ooh, here's five directors I like. Let me get them in a film and let them make a film. I don't give a damn. I just want to work with these guys.
You know what? I'm fucking okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, look at the quality, you know.
Well, you know, the Ken Russell segment is the last thing he ever directed. Because he died right after that.
No, he did a short film about Midget Hitler, but right before he died, that was BBC only.
Okay. Well, this is the last feature. Okay, then. We'll consider it that. And it's basically about a process of enhancing your boobs if you're a woman, and then they become bloodsuckers, and they get teeth. I mean, it's just garish Ken Russell. You can't get better than that. The Sean Cunningham is a Japanese J-whore, and he shot it in Japan. And it's actually very good. But the Monty Hellman
John Cunningham as a B-movie director is very underrated.
What, Sean Cunningham, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, of course, we know him most for Friday the 13th. course, I didn't prepare. I didn't know we were going to talk about Sean Cunningham. What else has
he
done?
Yeah, we know more Friday the 13th Part 2 and 3, the ones that he directed.
Right.
And you know I love 3. It's one of the best of the 3D movies, but he did things like Deep Star 6.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, not a great movie, but decent. What else? You know what else, Steve?
Yeah, hold on for a second.
Okay, fair enough.
Sorry, people, but...
We're trying to get it together here, you know. Sometimes it just doesn't work the way you want it to. God knows that's true. But as far as Trapped Ashes and Theater Bazaar, I'll go back to Theater Bazaar. One of my favorite actors is, now his name escapes me. Come on, the German guy, Steven, Gallbladder, Flesh for Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah. Don't call him the German
Udo
guy.
Kier.
Call him the New York guy. Or else he'd
kick
the crap
Udo
out
Kier.
Of him. He'd direct Paul Morrissey.
No, I'm not talking about the director. I'm talking about the star, Udo Kier.
Oh, Udo.
Udo. So in the Theater Bazaar, the wraparound is this woman who sees this theater across from the hotel that she's staying at. She goes in. And it's basically there's nobody there, deserted. And this puppet company comes out, and Udo Kier stars as his 6'3" frame marionette, who sort of like, you know, performs for her and introduces the sketches. And it's some of the creepiest shit I've ever seen. It's really good. And then
and
after that,
Blade,
he
was in Blade 2 as the King of the Vampires.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget fucking Iron Sky, man.
Yeah.
I love me some Iron Sky.
Yeah.
But yeah, Udo's been around for ages. And
I'm sorry,
I see
we can't
Udo,
get Richard Stanley connected. Well, we're going to fill up the rest of this hour in a little bit, so.
Oh, that's a shame. We can't do it?
No. But all the stuff you want to talk about, Videodrome is, we're going back to Videodrome, is valid, except that most people really don't talk about how badly Universal botched the theatrical release of this in America.
Well, they didn't know what the hell to do with it. Look at that movie. How the hell are you going to market it? Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, it was
well,
just so odd.
Look at how they marketed Eraserhead.
Well, what did they do? They didn't really market it. They threw it on the Midnight Circuit.
Yeah, but look at the trailer. It just shows that this is a dark industrial movie full of fucked up shit.
Right.
People are like, cool, I'll take it. That's how you sell it. I mean, you can definitely sell the movie on what is real, what is now, what is Videodrome, you know. But
mm-hmm.
what do we get? We got a bizarre dance club fucking thing.
Of course, they were betting that because Debbie Harry was in the film, it's 1982, and she's big in New York.
Yeah, that was their ace in the hole. They were betting on, you know, that's what they went for. They're like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh, we know Debbie Harry. And before
which,
you
had
the incident last night, you were going to talk about the movie's philosophy.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
Howitt stated that having a philosophy is what makes you dangerous.
Well, there's this great scene where he goes to Bridie, and he's and we're talking about James Woods' character, Max Wren, goes to Bridie and wants to find out about Videodrome, and she warns him off him. And she says, you know, Videodrome is dangerous because it has a philosophy. That's very true of the film itself. One of the reasons that the film has survived all these years and increased in its visibility and its cult status is because it has a major, major philosophy and thoughts on media and that. Of course, these days, if you take a look at Videodrome, the technology is dated, okay? Cathode ray TVs, VHS tapes. But the idea of information controlling you is completely prescient today with the internet and everything. I mean, it's scary how prescient that film is now.
Yeah.
And the idea of fake news. One of the great when Brian Oblivion says, you know, what is real is only what is on the TV set. You know, take that. What is real is what is only on the internet. You know, just update it, and then you'll see how dangerous this whole film is in philosophy. So, yeah, it's a really dangerous film.
Do you remember what David Cronenberg said? The only really screw-up he did on Videodrome was?
What?
He picked Beta to be the surviving format instead of VHS.
True, but, you know, even so, we've gone past that. You know, VHS or Beta don't exist now, and yet the film has extreme power because of the philosophy behind it.
Yeah.
That you know, oversees, you know, any sense of it, of the film being dated because of its technology or overriding.
The thing is that Max Wren don't care about anything. All he cares about is getting asses to watch his channel.
Yeah.
And Civic TV was a real thing. It was the first cable channel in Canada to lean towards the exploitation, the sex, and all that, the sleazy genre, as they say.
Right. You know, and of course, the idea for anyone is how many people are we going to get to listen? I mean, we're the same way. How many people are going to listen to this podcast? How many people, how can we get more people to listen to it? You know, these concerns with Max Wren, you say he doesn't have a ethical base, but anyone is going to think that who's in the arts. I mean, same thing with the internet and certain sites. And, you know, their idea is to get people to, and then of course, just like Max, you know, you muck that up with, you know, making wrong decisions and wrong ethical decisions, and suddenly you're caught into something you don't know what to do.
Well, look at Fox News. They have taken the Videodrome philosophy perfectly.
Yeah. Or the fake
news
sites.
Fuck
rake
and show the sleazy side of what they want to do. And then because they show the sleazy side, who will believe them and buy into what they say?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Same with the fake news sites and so on and so forth. One of the reasons we don't do Schwing now on a regular basis is because I had to verify everything. It was fucking impossible.
You went through a whole month where every story that was a good Schwing
was
verified
fake. Absolutely. Remember, I called you up one day. I said, this is fucking unbelievable. Yeah. All the good stories are fake.
Yeah, I mean, I really could, honestly, I couldn't see Videodrome being a hit in 82, 83 anyway, because we really didn't mention the true elephant in the room when it comes to those 2 years.
Okay, which, tell us about the elephant.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Absolutely.
It changed more over than Star Wars did.
Well, you know, I also, you also want to think of the other Spielberg movie, The Close Encounters. The idea of kind aliens, of this to be a heartwarming experience. And you get someone like Cronenberg, who's going back to the real 70s sense, like everything is fucked up. You know, it's really hard to sell that. And particularly someone as clinical as he is, too.
Yeah, and if you have the Criterion Blu-ray or DVD of Videodrome, there's this little segment on there they call The Class of 82. And what it has is four directors who have movies either come out late 81 or 82. They had John Landis with American Werewolf in London. That was a rare hit. You had John Milius with Conan the Barbarian. You had John Carpenter with The Thing and Starman, and David Cronenberg with Videodrome.
And then don't forget who was hosting the thing was Mick Garris, who you know is a producer and director in his own right. Maybe not at that time, but
yeah. But yeah, I mean, really, to us, that we just look at that and go, oh, and they looked at it and said, E.T. made money. E.T. went PG.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talk about the the box office and the companies. The production companies, you know, being so monetarily biased in the U.S., you know, and so on and so forth. But that's been true for the length of time, man. I mean, really, you know, it's a business. It's show business. So they are looking at the business side all the time. And so you get a point where if they think one thing's going to make money and you're making something completely different, basically you're fucked. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and that's another thing they get into Videodrome, too, because Max and Civic TV is really on the verge of being fucked. Because one of the arguments in the movie between the three bosses is that the two guys want to start making their own porn videos and showing it on their own channel. That way that they are going to be like 200% in control of all the content and any money made off selling that content, they'll make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, of course, he kills them. but it's, you know, that film is just a really, it means a lot to me. I mean, I have a great love of Cronenberg, and that film... Now, I do have to say, when I first saw that in the theater, I'd actually traveled to Toronto, Canada, and saw the Canadian cut, not the bastardized American cut. Do you want to talk about the American cut a little bit, how they really fucked it up?
Well, yeah, let's talk about 99 minutes to 79 minutes.
Yeah, let's take 20 minutes out of a... relatively dense and decipherable movie anyway, and make it more indecipherable and less coherent than it already is.
Yeah, they thought it was too slowly paced.
I don't get that. Seriously, I don't get that.
Yeah, if you ask me, of all of Cronenberg's films, Videodrome is his fastest paced film.
Well, except for Fast Company.
No, even Fast Company was a little bit slower paced than Videodrome. I mean, once Max Renz is exposed to the tape, it's bam, 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 bam. Not that many chance to really catch your breath.
Yeah, and of course he's throwing visuals and you don't know what's real, what's not, and he keeps you off balance throughout the whole film. Such a great movie. But of course, you know, you go on from this movie and what came out afterwards.
Well, let me do this as a connector. After Videodrome failed, David Cronenberg was less than one inch from quitting. He was just so depressed that he basically was seriously considering career. So as a last-ditch effort, he wanted to know if he had it in him to really work with the studio. And as we've seen in 1982 in there, we had a Creepshow. And in 1983, we had Christine and Cujo. So basically, during those 2 years, Stephen King said he was the town whore and everybody wanted to take a turn.
Right.
So David Cronenberg picked a movie about nobody.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting if you take a look at it. You know, you've got this director coming off all these body horror movies, and suddenly he picks the King adaptation that he ends up doing is one of the most slowest paced, most character-driven things that Stephen King has ever written. Basically, there's what, 8 characters in the whole book, I think. Really, 8 major characters.
And even in the movie, they slice down his mother's character. He cuts a lot of the religious part of it out.
Yeah, no, that I do know, which I understand why he did that. But I would have preferred it to be in there. Of course, we all know how connected I am to religious.
Well, it isn't the religious part. It's just that it drags it adds a little too much to the soup and drags it down a little bit, in the pacing.
Right. But, you know, you talk about the Dead Zone. And to me, it really boils down to three performances. I'm not saying anything against Maude Adams. She does a really good job in the female lead. But really what it comes down to Christopher Walken, comes down to Herbert Lom, and God damn does it come down to Martin Sheen.
Oh, God, yes. Damn. Martin Sheen's character in that is so pertinent. It's scary. But when I say it's about nothing, what is Christopher Walken's character name in the movie?
You know what? It escapes me. Please tell me.
John Smith.
John Smith.
Yeah, John Smith, John Doe.
No,
the way his character is set up for the accident, he really is a nobody. He's just a guy, meets a girl, who's a high school teacher, car crash that takes away a decade of his life, and then he has to deal with the ramifications of the accident.
Of course, the accident, you know, causes him to have visions. And that's where, of course, the story goes. Walken is just, this is probably, if I had to pick top 5 Walken performances, and that's hard, this is definitely in the top 5.
And don't forget
would you agree?
Tom Skerritt is great
as
the sheriff, too.
Yeah. Yeah, but what do you think? Would you consider this top five for Chris Walken?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and do you know what character they cut out of the Dead Zone, the movie?
What?
A reporter from the Tattle, a reporter from the Tattler. Richard Dees.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that name, Richard Dees, so important, Carl?
I have no clue. Please enlighten us, Stephen.
Stephen King wrote another short story on down the line called The Night Flyer.
Ah, yes. Now I remember.
The Richard Dees character. And if you look on his wall when the Night Flyer, you know, he has all of his old ads.
Right.
In the movie. One says, a psychotic man with tumor attempts assassination on presidential candidate.
Yep.
And I would call this and Dead Ringers. Wasn't Dead Ringers right after Dead Zone?
Pretty much so. It was the next year. It was late in the next year, so it did come out in 83.
Yeah. But what I'm talking about is Dead Ringers and The Dead Zone. It's Cronenberg's most humane movies.
As humane as he can get. I don't know if I agree with you in terms of Dead Ringers, because those twins creep me the fuck out.
Oh, I know they're creepy, but it shows their humanity.
Yeah, their flawed humanity, which I don't want to get anywhere near.
And same with The Dead Zone, too. We're looking at a man who's lost in time.
Mm-hmm. And, well, The Dead Zone, see, he is sympathetic. And you feel for him. There's no sympathy, really, for the characters. I tell you the one you're missing as far as sympathy for the characters and Cronenberg, and that's Brood.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing people never really talk about in Cronenberg's movies, is that he is very sympathetic to the human condition.
Oh, absolutely. And he's focusing on what, you know, body horror also translates into psychological horror in terms of, you know, what breaks down the condition? You know, what makes this happen? And The Brood is a perfect example of that, of the cycle of abuse. And if at the end of that movie with that last free shot, if your heart isn't, like, taken out of your body and stomped on and given back to you, if you're not a piece of jello, then you're not human.
Yeah, he deals with one of the ugliest subjects that we really didn't want to deal with in the 80s, and I don't think this even came into public discussion until the 90s. Tell me if I'm wrong. And that is the circle of violence.
Yeah, or cycle of abuse. And don't forget, we're talking the 70s with The Brood, not the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, but if you take a look at The Brood, that's exactly what it's about. And it's about how this abuse is handed down from generation to generation, and that there's no stopping it. And it's brutal. It's brutal. But, as I said, you know, these characters are sympathetic. Even Nora. She's even sympathetic. And don't forget that David Cronenberg was going through a really nasty child custody case at the time that he wrote that. So it's extremely personal.
Oh, and there's another guy from the Dead Zone we forgot. And this proves how fucking stacked the Dead Zone is, and that's Anthony Zerbe.
Oh, Anthony. Oh, God. I love him so much.
That scene after the team falls through the ice and they kill some of the people.
Right.
And he goes back and he says, "Why didn't you warn me, you son of a bitch? Why didn't you warn me?"
Yeah. Yeah. But, of course, we haven't talked about Martin Sheen. Now,
oh, good Lord.
I don't
man.
Like to get political on this show. I really try to distance myself and our listeners. However, when in our most recent election, which was almost a year ago,
yeah.
I basically went to Stephen and I says, "Oh my God, I think we've elected Greg Stilson."
Yeah, and how many posts were like that on social media?
Oh, good God. Yeah.
One of my favorites is showed a picture towards the end of the movie of Stilson standing at the podium.
Right.
And it said, "Deep meet your new president."
Yeah.
In the book, there's a little more history of Stilson that shows him coming up as starting as a snake oil salesman who was selling those Bibles and stuff like Andy Griffith in Facing the Crowd, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's almost who realizes how really deep a character is. Stilson is. I mean, he is the modern version of Andy Griffith in A Face of the Crowd.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, with what John Smith does at the end, that changes the whole trajectory of Stilson, and we no longer have the the denouement that he had envisioned in his visions.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll be the case now, too, so we'll see.
And what I love is about when you watch the book, you think, "Oh, my God, he's failed. He got shot. He didn't do it." But then Stilson grabbed his hand, and what was it he said? "I killed you."
Yeah. No, I think he says, "You're dead anyway."
Yeah.
I think that's the line.
Yeah. And then Stilson realizes about that photo. And that's another thing that's kind of real pertinent today. One photo or one incident can destroy your ass.
Yeah. No,
like
I mean,
Kevin Spacey dead in the water out of the day. After the day.
Yeah.
The reason I bring it up is I love the response of George Takei when, Spacey got caught molesting a boy and basically said, "Oh, I was drunk, but hey, I'm gay." And basically George Takei said something to the terms, not in these words of, "Fuck you for using that as a shield to try to hide to what you did to that boy, you son of a bitch."
Yeah. Yeah, that's all you need is to connect, connect being gay with being a pedophile. Thanks a lot, Stacy. Our LGBT friends, have enough to fight against. Asshole.
Well, he was just trying to deflect,
I know. No, but the media just, particularly the right wing media has really glommed onto that. if you're LGBT, if you're gay, then you're a child molester. That's why we need the transgender law, bathroom laws, and all that bullshit. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, this is really becoming a witch hunt, but in a way it's a good thing. I haven't seen it gone bad. .. yet.
Yeah. But you just sent me a picture. Why don't you tell the people about that? I find that really interesting.
This has been no news since about 82 that Ron Jeremy is a sleazy rapist scumbag. And after the 70s, pretty much 80 to 85, after 85, none of the girls would work with his ass. One, the motherfucker never washed, but that's little, that's like small potatoes next to the fact that he had a habit of, like, using his prick to hurt the girls on the set, literally.
No, so all these allegations came out, and tell them what happened with these allegations on Ron Jeremy.
Basically, it destroyed any career he had left.
Well, no, what did it say?
Oh, the worst one is that he anally raped Ginger Lynn.
Well, no. No, I'm not talking about the allegations or what he did. You sent me a meme where the AVN has basically said he's no longer going to be at any AVN outlets or anything like that, celebrations or award shows.
He's getting cut from all the retro porn cons and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's going to hurt him in the pocketbook. Big time.
Yeah, I mean, I was hearing these allegations back in the early 00s and in the freaking 90s. Margot was even talking about that.
Well, you sent me that notice. The first thing I sent back to you was a five-word reply, which said, "And this is a surprise?"
Yeah, nobody was surprised. It's surprising it took so long to get out. Later in the OOs, this is going to piss you off. He said, when asked about Ginger Lynn, he said, "Oh, I apologized to her and she forgave me, so that's that."
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
No.
No, I know. I'm agreeing with you on that.
It's like if I burnt your house down and I said, "Well, I apologize, Carl, for burning his house down, so it's all right."
Yeah, it's a shame. And the thing is, why is it? I've always wondered this. Because you know, we've had Richard Pacheco on. I'm friends with Tom Byron. Byron just came up with a thing, you know, he says, Harvey Weinstein, Ron Jeremy,
Kevin Spacey, Ron Jeremy.
You know, they all have money and they all accosted women. And here I am driving Uber to make ends meet.
Yeah.
God, wouldn't that be cool to have Tom Byron as your Uber driver?
God, yeah. I mean, I'm proud to say that none of our friends have ever been caught in that mess. Because even Carter come out and said after 85, Ron Jeremy kept calling him up and asking him why he wouldn't use him.
Well, did you see the post? Carter did a really nice post where he really thought about it for a while. And he said he certainly used his, such or not to get laid, but he didn't, it was that the women came up to him and wanted to. And he always said, what's the difference between power being an aphrodisiac and power being a power, something wielded to get what you want sexually? And he says, he certainly doesn't believe that he accosted any women, and I believe him on that. But what he was saying was, because of where he was and what he was doing, women availed themselves. And is that the same thing or not? Very
interesting. No, because in his era when he did it, cocaine was an evil bitch. The girl, Carter would get to use the girls to fuck him so he could get cocaine.
Right.
But the girls used him by fucking him to get the cocaine.
Right.
That's an ugly, vicious circle.
Yeah, cocaine, not good.
Well, any drugs like that. Because if you don't know a drug dealer that won't use, won't be used and be used, it's like a leech-like relationship, a parasitic relationship.
Well, you know what? If you really want to see a movie about that, go watch Paul Schrader's Light Sleeper.
Oh,
damn.
God, yeah. Well, Paul Schrader was a known drug user, too. So
absolutely.
He was speaking from experience.
Yeah, great film. 82 and 83
were interesting years, and it's sad that the movies that we hold dearest as classics in 82 and 83 were either barely released or flops.
Yeah.
Because what we would call the best of 82 and 83 would be, see if you agree with me, number one would be John Carpenter's The Thing, two, Videodrome.
Yeah.
And number three, Eyes of Fire.
Yeah, you know, you might go to Dead Zone, too. You know, I think Eyes of Fire isn't that high simply because it's still pretty much a cult item, and you know, I love me my bastard stepchildren, and I love that movie. But it's a great film, and maybe I would put it number three, but I don't think many people really would.
Well, that's because, like I said barely released.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, okay.
If you look at the VHS cover to Eyes of Fire, you wouldn't even know what movie it was. All you see on the cover is this little girl in a black dress looking all psychically and evilly standing in the woods.
Yep.
Well, yeah, now in the next ones that are coming up, 84, 85, we're going to really bring in the one thing that saved and killed the exploitation market.
VHS?
VHS, yeah. This is when you heard the rallying cry of all the exploitation and porn and sleaze directors. You mean I can still make money off this?
True.
And again, we apologize for our guests not showing up. And fuck you, we made up for last night, so hey.
There you go. Listen, thanks for coming in. Sorry that Richard wasn't able to join us. I hope he gets this so he can listen to it.
And we did a whole hour in that quick.
Yes, we did.
And really, if you can find it, get hardware, get the Dust Devil set because of the documentaries and the movie. And
don't forget the Fear Bazaar either.
His newest world, I forget what it is, Never World or something. And basically it's where he moved to, which he's in France right now. He moved close to the castle that reportedly is where the Holy Grail is.
Very cool. Very cool. And he has an upcoming birthday next year. Okay, we'll see you guys. Take care. Thanks a lot.
What is tomorrow,
bye.
Carl? What is tomorrow, Carl?
Oh, it's Halloween.
Yes, with me, Donna, Doc, and Mike House.
And don't forget me. Am I chopped liver?
I said me, Carl, Donna, Doc.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
And Mike House.
Went over my head.
So, see you in 24 hours and 30 minutes.
There you go. Listen, good night, everyone.
Good night. Stay creepy wherever you are.